The Big Red Bench. Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m. Cork's Red FM.
The Joanne O'Riordan Podcast. A Big Red Bench production for Cork's Red FM.
Hi, welcome back to the Joanne O'Riordan Podcast with me, Joanne O'Riordan. Coming up today, we've got part two of our interview with Clive Tinsley, where he goes into a discussion about his time as commentator, what commentary he finds best, and more importantly, his opinions on Billie Eilish. Tune in to find out what Clive Tinsley really thinks about everything.
When big moments happen in a game. So, like, you know, obviously we have press box rules and we're like, don't get too excited for your team in the press box. Like, my first official proper game was the Champions League semi-final, the Barcelona-Liverpool one in Anfield. And I basically went because they were like, it's done. Look, it'll be 200 words in the back page. It'll be grand. And I was like, okay. I was like, that should be super easy, you know? And I literally got there. And I remember there was like this like weird war because, oh, it wasn't accessible. And I was like, look, it's fine. I was like, just give me a spot with Wi-Fi. I'll manage, you know, I'll do my own thing. And just make sure I have a guard that I can be like, oh, can I go down after to get a few words? So I'm sitting there and I'm like keeping nice and tight because I'm like, look, you're in between a lot of Liverpool fans. Don't show your true colours here. And the corner was literally right under my nose. And just without noticing, I went, no! Just without noticing, like, do you find the commentary, you're nearly doing the same thing? Like, you're probably on such a high, you're looking at probably Trent Alexander-Arnold and you're like, PK, please, he's going to kick the ball, open your eyes.
Yeah, it's almost like a pantomime, isn't it? You know, behind you, you know, look out. Yeah, I mean, radio and TV are a little different. The biggest difference between the two is that you're just not as important on television. So get used to it, accept that, you know, deal with it. You know, we've all got vanities in broadcasting, but deal with it. You're really not important. This is a visual medium. So you're adding. All you're doing is adding. When you plug in as a radio commentator, I think you commentate from the heart more than anything. In TV, you need to use your head a little bit more. You've actually, or should have, a feed of the director, who is the most important person in the outside broadcast, the man or woman who's choosing which camera angle, which camera output the viewer sees it at any one time. And you've got to follow him or her. You know, they're leading the show. In radio, you don't. You are the lead. You're just hanging on for dear life to the action, going, no, whatever you're going in the stadium, really. In TV, you have the discipline and the privilege of not saying anything, because people can see. So, I mean, there's a famous piece of commentary. When did Woods win the Open? The Masters last year. I lose track of what year we're in now.
Yeah.
And there's a famous commentator, a sports commentator in the States called Jim Nantz.
Yeah.
N-A-N-T-Z. And you'd have to check exactly, but I believe that from Woods holding or picking the ball out of the hole on the 18th, Nantz said nothing for the next 3.5 minutes.
I was going to say, yeah.
Which, as a student of commentary, I was very interested to watch. And you can analyze it on all kinds of different levels. Certainly better to say nothing than to outwardly say, I have no words for this, you know, this is extraordinary, amazing, fantastic, wonderful, we've never seen it. That's not good enough.
Yeah.
You know, this is a guy who was one of the most famous sports people on the planet, arguably, given the mainstream nature of his sport, the best sports performer on the planet for a period, and whose life changed, whose career changed with his life. Mm-hmm. And who brought a lot of it on himself, and who was dogged by injury, who we never thought would return to the heights that he has. It is a wonderful story. And if you're sitting in the media tent with a keyboard in front of you, you're searching pretty hard for that intro. And so the TV commentator doesn't have to come up with that intro. Certainly buy yourself some thinking time to pick and choose your words over those next 3.5 minutes, so that they do amplify and somehow capture this extraordinary piece of sporting theatre. Now, as a student of commentary, I watched, I didn't listen because Jim didn't say anything.
Yeah.
Tiger Woods hugged 13 people from leaving the green to arriving at the scorer's room at Augusta. He hugged 13 people. I knew that a couple of them were his children, or at least I hope they were. Most of them I didn't know. Now, at what point is the commentator now indulging in something which is almost kind of my take on art?
Yeah.
To what point is now the commentator standing in the middle of a gallery staring at an empty frame, not realizing that actually they've taken the canvas out and it's just the frame that's hanging there? This is not a piece of art, guys. We are there to find a balance between entertainment, between editorializing, and between information. And I would like to have known who some of those people were.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure that I can. I mean, we're all a matter of opinion, and that, please print that. We are all a matter of opinion. One man's commentator is another man's pain in the backside. But as a student of commentary, nah, not for me. I needed a bit more than that, Jim. Sorry.
I was going to say it's really funny because, like, from a golf perspective, like me watching it as a golf fan, like I was content he said nothing, because even like, this isn't obviously going to print in my opinions here, but like me watching the Champions League final, having, you know, Steve McMiniman telling me basically a load of random stories, I was kind of sitting there going, just shut up, Steve. Just actually shut up for 5 minutes. I don't want to hear your voice for 5 minutes.
We're a matter of opinion.
No, it's true, though. But as you said, it would have been, like, it's funny you even say that, like, as a student of commentary, because for someone who's been in the game so long, do you find you're still learning just off a variety of models?
I hopefully retain the open mind to learn. And because the consumption of media is changing by the day, I've got to learn.
Yeah.
Because it's a little bit, I mean, I don't want to, and I know you won't decry the management style of Martin and Roy, because it's relevant. It would be perfect for certain circumstances. And some of the things that we learnt 20, 30, 40 years ago about how to broadcast, some of the things that I learned from Reg, I am absolutely convinced are as relevant today as they were then, but some aren't.
Yeah.
And actually keeping an eye out for the changes, or monitoring the changes, analyzing the changes, listening to other people's input on what they perceive to be good and bad commentary is because it's a constantly evolving platform. Mm-hmm. Then you've got to move with it. And maybe the empty stadia of the moment promote more conversational commentary. Even I'm not a great fan of the fake crowd effects, but it's not the same. And so maybe there is an argument for filling more of the gaps and actually discussing this whole concept of playing behind closed doors, which is kind of new and challenging. So yeah, I mean, but again, it's editorial. I think editorializing is a big word. You've seen the commentary charts that I prepare. If I'm using more than 10% of the information on there, then I'm probably boring the viewer. Some of my brethren who should have a crawler going across the bottom of the screen which says, "I've fucking well done this, so you're fucking well going to hear it." That's not editorializing. That's not good use of the information. I say it's a piece of journalism, I think. The thing that gives me most satisfaction, probably as a commentator, is not, good feedback on Twitter or Instagram or maybe even a pat on the back from my boss. If my conclusion at the end of the game, as it's happening, is reflected in Paul Hayward's intro to that game the next morning, then I feel as if I've got the story. It's a story, and I feel as if I've somehow captured the story, not as eloquently or with the reflection or the depth that he will, but we're basically on the same page, and the game's just finished, that he's on an hour or so, 2 hours later when he files his copies. So that's, let's say, we are storytellers to a degree, and but I'm talking about the journalistic story rather than the. This is not a piece. It is a piece of running copy, but it's got to be better than that if you're on television. You've got to be amplifying. You've got to be adding.
Yeah. Do you find now that like people are coming up to you? And you're probably like, oh my God, don't tell me. That makes me feel really old. But like people are coming up to you being like, oh my God, I remember where I was when you did X, Y, and Z. Like, do you feel that people have like weirdly grown up with you? Like
I suppose I'm a bit wary of it because of I'm maybe now reaching a stage where I feel as if I'm almost going to fight back against any suggestion of ageism. And that's a big subject, which... is another discussion. But actually, if people, I've had people say you were the soundtrack to my childhood or something, you know, something as kind of lyrical as that. And that is when we were at our most impressionable. And I think we still listen to the people that we listen to as young people, that we learn from as young people. I think I've got a particular soft spot for an old school teacher or a university lecturer or just a kindly uncle who seemed to get you and, you know, even better than your parents. If you bump into them 15, 20 years later, the affection is still there and the respect is still there and you want to hear some more from them.
Yeah.
That's how I codify it. Maybe what they're saying is you're an old, outdated fart. But they don't say it in those terms, and I don't hear it in those terms. I take it as a compliment, and I'm quite touched by it. Yeah.
But even now, like you know, your commentary charts, like the Liverpool one that I bought was for a friend of mine's mom. She's like a diehard Liverpool fan, and I honestly don't think marriage actually got as close to how she felt when she opened your present. Honestly, like the message I got was like, I thought she would ring me crying. But do you find that now, like that people, when they're buying these stuff, like it's just tapping into like something, is it like just tapping into like childhood or does it unlock something in them that they just wouldn't have thought was there before?
Yeah, I'm not very nostalgic as a person. I think partly because I'm happier now than I've ever been in my life. So, I'm no more down with the kids than Jacob Rees-Mogg, but you know, I will try to listen to contemporary music. I will try to watch contemporary cinema. Only because occasionally you find Billie Eilish who can write as well as Joni Mitchell did, you know, when I was at university. And even though she's very young, I first heard Billie Eilish, I would think, I don't know, when was Bellyache? 3 years ago, something like that.
Yeah.
And it may tell you something about my personality. I'm quite enamored by a young person who writes about having some dead people in the boot of her car, some dead friends in the boot of her car. I'm thinking you're a little bit different, and anything that's a bit different, you know, particularly as she's quite lyrical and the music's good to listen to. I don't think there's anything clever or unusual about being touched by things that are happening today as much as you were things that happened when you were in your formative years. It's just widening and actually gaining more breadth and enjoying your life more than you were before you found Billie Eilish. Only a little bit more, but a little bit more. I don't like everything she's made any more than I liked everything that Joni made. But you tap into certain things which just keep your mind open, keep sort of broadening your experience. You know, I've got a big thing about experience. Experience is not should not be measured in years. It should be measured in experiences and how they touched you. You're an extraordinarily experienced person because of all the things that have already happened to you, you know, over and beyond my experience, and I'm 66. So, you know, and as long as you've kind of digested and processed everything that's happened to you, and it's kind of added and produced the personality and the direction that you're heading in, you're experienced. You know, you're incredibly experienced already. So, I don't have any big problem with my past, because I like my present even more, and so consequently, I think I can continue to remain relevant to people of all ages. I mean, we've got, say, four offsprings in their mid to late 20s. They're among my best friends in the world. It's my parental duty to resonate with them. Mm-hmm. So, I would reel vehemently against any suggestion that because I'm 66 years of age, I can't connect with people in their 20s. And by the way, the population's growing older. Yeah. You know, if you're a broadcast organization that believes you need to employ 25-year-olds in order to communicate with 25-year-olds, the good news for me is that they're going to need octogenarian commentators to commentate all the people in care homes in years to come. You know, I'll still be relevant to the people of my age by that. No, it's nonsense. You it's broadcasting. You've got to be able to write for people twice and three times your age. They're all Irish Times readers. Mm-hmm. When you're broadcasting to 28 million people, you've got everybody. You know, when you're doing an England World Cup semi-final, and you better try not to leave anybody out, because as Reg taught me, that they all count one.
Yeah.
And so I think it's almost demeaning towards young people to suggest that you need that young people need some kind of youth culture throwing at them. But they can get that just by turning their head, because they're likely to be in the company of people of their age anyway. So they can get that. In order to get the background and the backstory that I took to life, that I think young people have a natural restless appetite for, they need to talk to older people and hear from older people with more of these experiences.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, what had inspired you to do the commentary charts? Was it you opened the press and was like, oh God, I have so much paper? Or was it like, oh, this is a really cool niche idea?
Well, the bad news of not being particularly nostalgic is I'm not a hoarder. So I'm afraid, you know, people sort of say, you commentated on that game and, you know, in 1327 between the Picts and the Celts. I haven't got the commentary channel anymore. Sorry, it's gone. Why? You throwing it away? Yeah, it was a great game there, you know. So I keep the charts that I think will be relevant for for sort of reference. And I've given a number of Fergie had the I took like he's my best mate. So Alec Ferguson had the commentary charts from Manchester United's two Champions League finals, my original commentary charts, framed in his office at Carrington, which is lovely. And they are a kind of they're a strange memento, because most mementos capture the whole event. These are actually a screenshot of the event at kickoff.
Yeah.
If you have Manchester United versus Bayern Munich framed in your downstairs loo, it tells you nothing of what Sheringham and Solskjaer did. They're just down at the bottom of the page. Yeah. There's two guys who might not even come on. And so in a strange sort of way, it's left to you to tell the story to anybody who looks at it, about where you were, who you were with, what you remember about. You may have been in the Camp Nou. You may have been, you know, listening to it on the radio as I was as a kid and illegally under a duvet. But that little piece of football memorabilia at least tells you where we all were at kickoff. And then you add your own. You add your own context and your own narrative to it. So it's a strange memento in that sense. And I think just during lockdown, I started doing some quizzes, a daily quiz, where I kind of got one of my old charts out and covered up a name and asked people from the clues, yeah, you know, who is it? And we got a nice response to that, and people sort of saying, can I have the chart? No, you can't. It's going back in my file. And a friend of ours, Chris Stark, who's a broadcaster on Radio 1 over here, he just said, you should publish these, you know, you should, and so he's actually in the business with us, and it's a cottage industry which has grown into an outbuilding industry, and who knows? It's the reaction, as you said, Joanne. It's the reaction which is warming. I mean, you know, I think we'd stop the moment people sort of say, "This is just a bit of cardboard." I'm sorry, I don't know why I bought this, but people actually do add their own stories to it, and it does mean something to them.
Yeah, because even like that woman now, like that I referenced, like anytime I'm doing any interviews, like football interviews or whever, I can't call Kenny Dalglish only King Sir Kenny because of her. And like, no matter what I'm doing, I'm like, yeah, King Sir Kenny. And they're like, no, he's just Sir. And I'm like, no, it's King Sir Kenny. And we're in the office one day, we're trying to figure out, is it Sir King Kenny? King Sir Kenny? Kenny Sir King? How would he like to ever do? We're like, we're just settling on King Sir Kenny. But yeah, I even found myself just sitting one day doing an interview with someone. I was like, yeah, King Sir Kenny. And they were like, no, you have to call him by his proper name. I was like, that is his proper name.
Yeah, well, funny enough, the chapter in the book, I did worry over it, and it is King Kenny. I called it, the chapter's called King Kenny. The opening words are, Sir Kenny Dalglish is, I think I'd say he's the most childish adult I've ever met. But for a couple of months in the spring of 1989, he was the most adult on the entire planet. And it's a little bit about, because he's a mischievous, boyish character to this day. His humor is infantile. He is somebody who takes as much delight in catching you out with a stupid practical joke as he would from scoring a winner at the Gladys Street End in a Merseyside derby. And he, through no volunteering of his own and through no fault of his own, had to steer an entire game out of the shadow of just the most awful disaster in the spring of 1989, when he'd only signed up to be the manager of a football team, and you know, King Kenny and Marina were just extraordinary in those months, and you know that why the knighthood wasn't conferred on him at the end of that season, I don't know. But then there are a lot of questions about Hillsborough that we've only managed to answer after 20 years of agonising. So yeah. I think it's a good chapter in the book. You know, we've actually published the chart from the final league game of that season, because strangely, a lot of football fans never associate Michael Thomas's winning goal for Arsenal at Anfield with that season. Yeah. It spoiled the story, really, because Liverpool had won the FA Cup final against Everton.
Yeah.
In this huge sort of atmosphere of tribute and a Merseyside identity. And you're part of the story of Arsenal winning the league that night at Anfield, is that there seemed an inevitability that Liverpool would then go on and finish the story by getting the draw that they needed, or the 0-1 defeat that they needed to clinch the title. And sport spoils those stories and rewrites its own version of it. And so, yeah, I mean, to Arsenal fans, that is a special memory. But I was working as a local radio commentator on Merseyside at the time. And so I probably view that now, even though Lee Dixon and Alan Smith, who played big part in the winning goal, are really close friends of mine to this day. You know, I remember Steve McMahon walking around saying 1 minute, and they were 1 minute away from, you know, and these guys who, I mean, Kenny and Marina were amazing, but so were the players.
Yeah.
You know, they had to do a lot of counseling of bereaved families during that time. Guys of 24, 25, 26 years of age, who had everything they'd wanted in life given to them, really, because of their football ability and the right place, right time. And, I remember sitting, there was a young guy a very young guy called Ian Whelan, who died that day, who had wanted to be a commentator. And I'd shown him around Radio City just a couple of months earlier. And his nickname was Ronnie. And I was introduced to the family at Anfield. They'd wanted to meet me. But then I introduced them to Ronnie and Elaine. And Ronnie was, I don't know, you'd have to look it up, probably 25 years of age. You know, I'd been drunk with Ronnie Whelan. I've been drunk with him since. He was not prepared to sit down with a family of a 16-year-old, I think Ian was, who's adapted your name as a nickname and went to watch you in a football match and never came home.
Yeah.
And would you like to sit down with this family for 5 minutes? Jesus fucking Christ. What? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll do it. And they did it. They did it. Extraordinary. It's part of the story.
Yeah, because even the odd few times I've met John Aldridge, like just hearing any of the stuff that have like gone on. Because ironically, the first time I met him, it was with Jason McAteer, who were all at a game. And I was trying to squeeze through. And I was like, oh, sorry, being really nice and innocent. And the back of my wheel caught Jason McAteer's ankle. And my brother yelled, oh, Joanne's put Jason McAteer out for 6 months now. Good girl, Joanne. So that's my, it's my line with Jason McAteer. And I was even like, oh, I'm the girl who tried to put you out there.
Well, I mean, another Irish international who is a huge friend to this day and somebody I've worked alongside, Jim Beglin. Jim suffered an injury as horrendous as any as I've seen on a football field in a Merseyside derby at Goodison Park. And Jim was a really close friend at the time. And the guy that perpetrated the challenge, Gary Stevens, was also a really, really close friend. And, you know, Jim tells the story of how he woke up in a daze in the hospital and Bob Paisley, who was his manager and had a reputation for a kind of an innate insight into what an injury was as soon as it occurred. He used to be the sponge man at Liverpool, you know, no medical training, but as soon as he saw a player go down, he would say cartilage and it would be a cartilage. And Jim woke up in this hospital bed and the first person he saw was Elaine and the next Elaine Beglin. Yeah, they're both Elaines, aren't they? Yeah. And the second person he saw was Bob, who shook his head and said, worst one I've ever seen, son. So Gary wanted to go and visit Jim in hospital, and Jim didn't particularly want to see Gary, and through a kind of, you know, my friendship with Jim, I persuaded him, please, you know, just see him privately, just kind of wants to say sorry, even though it wasn't a bad foul really. Jim sort of kicked against Gary. I eventually arranged this meeting and drove Gary to the hospital and took a newspaper and sat in a chair. I can see it now outside the room when Gary went in. And I just about opened it and Gary came out again. And I said, okay, said sorry. Okay, that was it, you know. And that was all that Jim wanted. Jim sort of nodded his head. I've heard the conversation from both sides. But it was important to both of them, I guess. But it was rather comedically short conversation. The kind of things I've written about, just being around those moments, those extraordinary moments from these extraordinary people, and how they adapt their lives to everything that happens to them as footballers.
I was going to say, do you learn like weird personality traits that you adapt in your life? Like, you know, you were saying about Liverpool and obviously Hillsborough, you probably learned like mad resilience and God knows what other emotion you could even tie onto that without sounding too cliche. And then, you know, for Martin and Roy, you learned, you know, professionalism is key, give it 100%. Like, you know, as Roy Keane would say, and my English teacher, you know, fail to prepare, prepare to fail. You know, like, have you learned these weird kind of personality traits just by being around them?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the kind of tenor of the book, really. The soonest book is, the soonest chapter, it's about soonest and Roy, really. There isn't a Roy Keane chapter. But the soonest chapter is about how strange it is that I've become so friendly with them when if I had been a footballer, I would have truly hated them. Because they they had a serial desire to win a football match, which overrode everything else, including your health and welfare. And they were both freely admitted now. And Graham's a particularly, I mean, they're both quite gentle people. Graham's a particularly warm and kind of emotional man. You know, he's been through a fair bit since then himself too. So yeah, it is quite enlightening. But I think I wrote a line about it in the Fergie chapter that we should never try to judge these people by normal standards, because they are extraordinary people. I think great is an overused word in sport generally, but they are extraordinary in so much that this is one of the biggest rat races in the world, because everybody wants to be a footballer. So the guys that actually achieve, it's the greatest meritocracy in the world, because you can buy a football club, but you can't buy your way into a football team. You've just got to be good enough, and in this case, determined enough and competitive enough. And so when you look at Sir Alex Ferguson and how he conducted his business, as you can't compare him to anybody else in your life, because that's why he got there, because he was different. He was truly extraordinary, and his drive and his energy and his hunger for success on behalf of Manchester United. No, it wasn't a great vanity.
Yeah,
he was trying to deliver success for his employer effectively. So yeah, you do learn from Joanne, and I think that's quite astute of you, and I'm sure you feel the same. But you can only learn so much about yourself, because you're not them. You're actually not like them. And that's the first thing you've almost got to recognize and appreciate, that I'm not like Graham and Roy, except that they both appreciate my preparation and my thoroughness and my professionalism and my determination to be as good as I can be when I perform.
Exactly. I was going to say, to like wrap this up, because I feel like we could actually talk for like forever. Not gonna lie.
As long as you've got a story somewhere.
Yeah. No, there is definitely. God, there's loads of stories. My brain is going into overdrive. It's like, Oh my God, your poor editor, RIP. But your story about Ballybofey, because I'm only curious, because as we Shamrock Rovers are welcoming AC Milan, obviously tonight. Europa League. So how and what brought you to Ballybofey, which by the way is 5 hours away from me? And I've only been once. You've actually been the same amount of times, which I don't know what that says about me.
Well, we went up to, I went on a golf trip up to Rosapenna, and what's the other great course up there, which gave me a great insight into the whole county, really. Because I did get the impression that whilst everybody was very, very warming and welcoming, there was a feeling that Dublin had forgotten about them about 50 years ago. And obviously the whole county kind of gravitates a little bit more towards Derry than it does towards Dublin. So you do learn. You learn every time you visit anywhere. The great story about Everton versus Finn Harps, you'd have to look the year up. I'm guessing 78, maybe 79. So we're talking about the height of the Troubles, and an English football team could not fly to Belfast and then drive on to Ballybofey. It just wasn't allowed. So we flew to Dublin. And, of course, pretty much pre-World Wide Web days, me gaining any kind of information on Finn Harps for my commentary chart on that particular game was difficult. But I'd managed to, through a few phone calls and stuff, to get a certain amount of information. But when we arrived at Dublin Airport for this coach journey up through the middle of Ireland, and actually I think part of the journey was actually through Northern Ireland before we came out the other side, we were met by, and I'm going to tell you his name now, the president of the club, who was a very well-known man in Irish football. He may even have been president of the Irish FA for a spell. I'll look it up if I don't remember. And he was just the most charming advert for an archetypal Irish host that you could ever wish to meet. What was he called? I think his son actually took over from him. Anyway, well, I'll find that for you.
Yeah.
And I explained, I introduced myself before we got on the coach, and he said, no worries, you sit next to me and I'll tell you anything you need to know about Finn Harps and any of the players on the way up. And so literally I sat next to this guy who was the president of the club, and we'd started with the goalkeeper, and he said, yeah, he was in the Irish squad last year. I said, oh, wow, I didn't know that. He'd been called up. Yeah, yeah, he didn't play, but he was in the Irish squad, and, you know, this, that and the other. So I got all this information together, and on the day of the game, the following day, I went down to the stadium to look at our commentary position, and I met a local journalist, and he introduced himself, and we exchanged a bit more information. And I said, I'm actually pretty much okay with the players, because I had this, this 3 hours on the coach. Where he said, oh, he said, what did he tell you? I said, well, I didn't know the goalkeeper had been in the Irish squad. He said, no, he hadn't. He hasn't. He played under 16 for Ireland. I said, yeah, but he said he trained with the city. He said, no, no. Said there was a bit of speculation that he might get called up, but it never happened. And we went through every player. And every piece of information that he'd given me had been garnished and amplified. There was a certain element of truth in all of it, but it wasn't actually factual. And so I had to revise my entire commentary chart for Finn Harps versus Everton with correct information. Okay, then. Yeah, we're pretty much at the end. Sorry, yeah. John. Yeah.
You're all right.
So, yeah, and his name is, gosh, I'll get it for you. I'll yeah, email you. Right. Yeah. I'll email you in the next 10 minutes. But he is a well-known guy, and a lot of the readers will remember him.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, that sounds exactly like someone from Donegal. I don't know if you heard the expression, you're up there, if you're called, because I was up there recently and they called me a hitter. And I was like, I don't know if that's an insult. And they were like, oh, it just means you're like crazy, like you're a wild one. I was like, I don't know how I feel about being called a hitter. Like, I'll take Roy Keane calling me a langer any day over a hitter, no bother, because at least I know where that means.
I'll give you one last story, which I think will fit in somewhere, about another Irish manager, a very recent Irish manager. I played golf in Portugal in a charity event about 10 years ago. And in the kind of reception beforehand, I came into a conversation with Mick McCarthy through a mutual friend. And the mutual friend said, do you two know each other? And I held my hand out to Mick and said, yeah, yeah, we know each other. And Mick said, no, you don't. And by the way, you know, well, I'll tell you at the end that, you know, we are really, really close friends now. We've had dinner several times with our wives and stuff. And so, and I said, yeah, well, when I say I know him, I said, I've interviewed him many times and, you know, we talked after games. And he said, that's not Mick McCarthy. And I said, what do you mean? He said, the guy who comes out for the post-match interview, he said, that's not Mick McCarthy. He says, because you can amplify the language. He says, because I've just lost 3-0 and I'm coming out and you're the first person that I'm going to speak to and you're going to ask me all kinds of difficult questions that I don't want to answer. He said, so that I'm not Mick McCarthy when you're interviewing that person. I'm the manager of Wolves or whoever I am. And it was actually Mick's, you know, mischievous way of making a serious point, but almost saying that from this moment onwards, our friendship will be different. You will now meet Mick McCarthy. And sure enough, I have met and got to know Mick and Fiona McCarthy. And we've had, you know, supper together with my wife, Susan, and we would count them as genuine friends. And now I do know Mick McCarthy and I do know what he means. And I think you can relate that to a little bit of what we've been talking about with Roy, yeah, with Sir Alec, that, you know, they are performers and we put them on this stage, we shine the spotlight on them, and they have to behave like, you know, politicians, diplomats, you know, representatives of huge multinational organizations, of huge investments of emotion and passion by the supporters. And if they say one wrong thing or they make one U-turn, you know, they'll be castigated and it will appear on their record. And so, yeah, it is wonderful to spend time in their company and learn from them. But at the same time, to to repeat what I said about Saranik. We're not like them. That what makes them successful is their difference. And so don't judge Roy Keane by your standards. Don't judge Martin O'Neill by your standards. Don't judge Mick McCarthy by your standards, because they are where they are and they played the part in your lives that they have because they're different from you.
That was our interview with renowned and world legendary commentator Clive Tilsley. Coming up next week, we've got an incredible story. We talked to the very first Irish female mountaineer and rock climber who's travelled, I'd say, a couple of million peaks and has loads of little rock climbings named after her. That's right, we are interviewing the one and only Claire Sheridan, who next year will be celebrating 50 years of mountaineering, and we'll talk about how she's trademarked her way through rock climbing and blazed a trail for women all over the world. Tune in next week and find out. And also don't forget to follow us on social media at @JoanneOr_OX and at Big Red Bench. Tune in and enjoy. Cheerio.
The Big Red Bench. Saturday and Sunday from 6 p.m. Cork's Red FM.